myself that took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
That these fellas will get such a shit shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their asses for 10 years.
Cork, beaten by Meath in 1967. Beaten by Meath in 1987. Beaten after a replay in 1988. Are the 14 men to prevail in front of their loyal band of fans? The subs wait. The double has been achieved. It's Cork's All-Ireland. It's Cork's year. The double in hurling and the double in football.
So there you go, Colin, the double. The double was done in 1990 by Cork, and they beat Meath for the first ever time, 67-87, and a replay after 88. So had lost four times in All-Ireland finals to them, or lost three times and drawn once, and lost league games to them as well. Never beaten Meath. Isn't that incredible? So to beat the team you'd never beaten before and do the double, and this double is for the first time ever as well, because, you know, in the modern game, I think it was club teams that it was done three times before, but I think it was club teams that represented the county back then. So the first time ever to be done by a county team, especially in the modern era, a phenomenal achievement.
Yeah, double. It was a double-double, isn't it, really, with the hurling as well? And like, even if you look after that 1990 team, or both teams who did that, like, it hasn't, obviously hasn't been done since, but provincial wise it's only been done three times, twice by Cork and once by Dublin in 2013. Like, you know, that's a team winning hurling and football in their provinces, so shows how rare it is to have two powerhouse teams in hurling and football in the one county at the same time.
Well, it does, yeah. I think Offaly were close in 1981. They had won the hurling and they lost the football to Kerry. They ended up winning the football in 82, so they were close back around that time as well. But Teddy McCarthy, he started both games. He'd be forever remembered in Cork for, you know, he won two. Imagine winning two All-Irelands in 3 weeks.
Yeah, like that. Like that man should never have to buy a pint again in Cork. Like that's unbelievable. Carry on.
Yeah, Cork in 1999 almost did it as well. Sean O'Halpine would have done it. So Cork won the All Ireland hurling on a really wet day against Kilkenny. They weren't expected to win that one, and then they lost. Who do you think they lost in 1999? Of course, it had to be Meath that stopped Sean O'Halpine going down in the same history as Teddy McCarthy. But that's it. Well, like, I mean, Jewel, to be honest, even though there was a big kind of controversy and talk about no Jewel players anymore, but there's an example from 91 in a Jewel county and 99 in a Jewel county, and they only had the one.
Yeah, but even just having successful Jewel teams, like, you know, at the same time, it's so rare. And when I was going through it, I assumed there might have been like a handy one in Ulster, like where Down had a good hurling team in the 90s and they won obviously Ulsters, but they didn't even coincide either. And if you just look at the football double as well, like, you know, obviously it was well documented. It took 17 years then for Kerry to win back-to-back football All-Irelands. Like, it doesn't happen that often. Dublin are routine to do it since. Obviously, they've ruined it for everybody. But, you know, Cork putting together two All-Ireland football titles is amazing. And then the fact they were able to do it with hurling as well, it's just, well, obviously it's never been done before.
Yeah. Meath, I suppose, won two together just before Cork. So the county hurlers were in the stand dressed in suits waiting for the second leg of the double to be done. So I'm sure that was a strange one. So yeah, I suppose the counties that could potentially do it now would be Galway, would probably be the top of the list. Galway and Cork would be the two counties you would imagine.
Dublin would be next.
Yeah, Dublin would be in the shake-up probably because they're almost a guaranteed football.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
you've got 50% of it done automatically.
Yeah. This rivalry though, Cork and Meath, like, I mean, this had reached kind of toxic levels. They had met in four All-Irelands, like I mentioned at the start of the show. 87, Meath won handy. 88, they drew. Meath were lucky to draw. And Meath won the replay in a very, very rough, hard-hitting encounter. That's not on YouTube, unfortunately. And then the 1990 match, which we were watching. And there was also an ill-tempered, really bad, nasty National League semi-final. And that was in 1990 as well. So, like, people thought this 1990 final, there was going to be war. And it didn't turn out like that at all. There was no real war in it, except for Colm O'Neill sending off. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it was funny. I was reading, Larry Tompkins said that Billy Morgan, after they lost that league semi-final in 1990, like, this is just another loss to Meath and another dirty match. I think Niall Catalan got sent off. He says Billy got down on his knees in the dressing room and prayed to Almighty God that those bloody boys in the other dressing room would reach the All-Ireland final, because we'll be there. And Tompkins says that was a turning kind of point of their season.
Isn't that unreal? Like, to put that much backing in a team as well. Like, you know, we'll be there. Like, I could have really.
No, that was a nice line. That was a nice line. We'll be there. Let's just hope those losers will be there to join us.
Yeah, let's hope they'll be there so we can spank their asses, basically. And, like, actually, Tompkins said in his speech afterwards, he's never met a man with so much self-belief and determination and a fierce will to win as Billy Morgan. So probably sums up his effect. And I'd say, like, those things stick with you as well. Like, when you see a manager going down on his knees in the changing room, like, you know, praying to God, like, you know, it's very emotive, and I'd say it would drive you on in training.
Yeah, so Colm O'Rourke said about the 88 replay. So this is when it got kind of toxic, like I was saying. So the first match, Meade just got a draw, but they kind of thought Cork had roughed them up a little bit in that game, because Cork had lost the 87 match against them. And O'Rourke said Dinny Allen left Mick Lyons semi-concussed. Niall Catalan left Brian Stafford semi-concussed. And he said he received one of the worst wallops on the football pitch when Barry Coffey caught him completely open. I think he had to spend a little bit of time in hospital. So Meade were rearing. Imagine pissing Meade off. Like, Meade is not a team that you really want pissed off. So Meade were out for revenge in that replay in 88. And Cork knew it. Because Billy Morgan said in his book, he said, this was his message to the players: if there's a row, the whole team should pile in. Not necessarily throwing digs, but backing each other up. But throw digs if you have to, right? So then Jerry McEntee was sent off after 6 minutes for hitting Niall Catalan in that game, because, you know, it was just simmering over the edge, and Meade won it with 14 men. Right. So, like, I mean, Billy Morgan never forgives himself for this, because his message to the Cork players then, which in real time, it's not a bad message. His message was to play football now, no retaliation, no piling in, you know, because they had a man extra and he didn't want to get sucked into this kind of messing with Meade and, you know, get a man sent off themselves, which sounds like a sensible thing to do. But then he said in his book, he said, it was the biggest mistake of my football life. Meade roughed us up afterwards and the boys didn't respond in kind because of my instructions. It was like giving them guns without ammunition. So interesting stuff, isn't it?
That's really, really interesting, especially, like, you know, if they're thinking of Meath as a team that they have to be ready for that confrontation with, and then suddenly it is taken away from them, then it's probably hard for them to deal with. And, you know, like, if you're taking a belt off a player or being roughed up and you're not reacting, it's hard. Like, you know, if you're not reacting in any sort of way, even with a shoulder or whatever else, I can see where he was coming from, because obviously we've got the man extra. But it is interesting, because there's a book by Adrian Russell, Double Double, and apparently when Larry Tompkins came down to Cork, him and Shea Fahey had sort of this big Meath for beginners induction for the whole Cork squad. And it was like, because they'd lost to Meath minors in 1980 and they knew all about them from their Kildare days. And basically it was like, lads, forget about what you think of Kerry v Cork. This isn't a rivalry. Like, Meath are a different animal altogether. And the whole thing was them trying to get them ready for playing Meath and what they were going to expect. So it seemed to be drummed into Cork from, like, late 80s that they have to be physical to match Meath. And, like, you know, you can see where those confrontations came from.
Yeah, because Cork were a big team as well. Like, I mean, there were no shrinking violets. Because some of the Cork players after 88 refused to travel to the Monday banquet, which was a crazy kind of thing at the time. I was at one in 1996 when Meade drew with Mayo. And we were after beating Kerry. And I think that could have been the last year. And maybe it was coming to the end. So all four teams would meet for a dinner in the Burlington Hotel on the Monday after the All-Ireland. Like, such a mad thing to do. Like, one team is on a high celebrating. The other team is, you know, completely distraught. And then they have to go meet each other and have dinner. Anyway, it's silly. They don't do it anymore. But some of the Cork players refused to travel, refused to go to that. And then, even more incredibly, later on that year, they both went on team holidays and they ended up in the same resort.
The GA holiday package being exposed there. Sending them off on the same deal.
That happened with the Galway and Waterford hurlers. I think that happens a bit, actually.
Yeah, they obviously get a deal on Groupon. Just book them all in straight away and forget about the rivalries. I, like, the team banquet thing, part of me actually thinks it's nice, almost a shame that it's gone. It's a bit of a sportsmanship. Just, you know, whatever happened on the field has happened, and we're all just the same amateur people at the end of the day. Let's talk about it now. Like, because I think, did you mention it was only after John Cairns had passed away? I think you have in your notes there, like, you know, that they actually got together again, or both teams got together again. And, you know, that's a shame that it brings something like that to bring them together, because although they're big rivals and obviously one team's heartbroken, they're still the same. Like, they have a whole lot in common, actually, if they started talking.
Yeah, apparently they're all great friends now, but it did take that funeral. Martin O'Connell said the thing that changed it all was John's death. Unfortunately, it took a death to break the ice between Meath and Cork. That put it all into perspective. And apparently they're really good friends. Like, I mean, I think the whole Meath team travelled down to that, and, you know, I think the differences were put aside at that stage. Look, at the end of it, you're right. Like, and they both won two All-Irelands at that time. Like, I think it was Larry Tompkins said, if either one wasn't there, you could have been looking at four in a row. Well, Dublin beat Meath in 89, but Cork were in four finals in a row. Like, I mean, they would have been confident potentially of winning it, you know, maybe a three in a row, or, you know, being remembered as an unbelievable team if Meath hadn't been around, who were an exceptional team as well. But anyways, the big talking point from the game is the Colm O'Neill sending off. And I wouldn't mind Colm O'Neill had been playing well. It's funny he's called Colm O'Neill, playing in the full forward line for Cork. He was playing well. I don't know what he was getting frustrated for. He was after being fouled a few times by Mick Lyons. He was getting on ball. He'd rattled the crossbar. Like, I mean, why did he do what he was doing for? And Mick Lyons didn't even do anything major to him. Like, he just looked for the, you know, the usual, give us the ball back. You fouled the ball. I want the ball to take my free.
Yeah, it was, and as you say, it was the one ball that Mick Lyons had won. Colm O'Neill was flying, you know, yeah. He had that chance, that he rattled the crossbar, he won the freeze that they had tapped over. You know, he was looking sharp, and then, like, it wasn't even like Mick Lyons got the better of him in that duel. O'Neill was out in front again.
He fouled the ball,
and it was like, oh, so stupid as well, because the ball was right. He just sort of tossed the ball away. So everyone's looking at the two of them because the ball's there, and he points at them, you know, for no reason. And in fairness to Mick Lyons, he barely reacts. He sort of feels his jaw and carries on. And it was, you know, it looked like a tough punch. And for Lyons just to not even, like, throw himself to the ground or not even see his head go back or anything, it really showed that he was made of tough stuff. But also it had me thinking, is Mick Lyons, you know, judged a bit harshly? I think we're always seeing him as this psychopath. I think somebody called him that in the Meath team before, how lucky they were to have him. But yeah, like, all these games I've watched now, these classic games, Mick Lyons seems to be the one getting hit because people are ready for him.
Yeah, no, I agree. The matches they've seen, but, like, I mean, look, they both got their names taken early on in the game, whatever went on off the ball. I'd say Mick Lyons was so cute. He'd be a bit like, if a tiger wants to kill you, you won't see the tiger. If he wants to kill you, you won't see him coming. So maybe Lyons does all his damage off the ball. But yeah, I think you're right. And the way he walked away without even pretending that he had been punched. Now, I don't know, was it a haymaker of a punch? But the reality was, even in those days, if that wasn't a straight sending off, he'd already been put into the book. So, like, there was no question Colm O'Neill had to go off. And then it was funny, Lyons won a ball a minute later after Colm O'Neill went off, and the whole crowd booed poor Mick Lyons. The poor man had done nothing.
He'd done nothing. His man picked the ball up off the ground and then punched him. Lyons didn't even fall to the ground or anything, foul him. He didn't do anything. And yeah, I don't know, it's funny because it just reminded me of a story that I heard about Bernard Flynn in training. Like, you know, as me, we're getting back to, you know, this All-Ireland winning form, and apparently Bernard Flynn turned around at one stage and punched Mick Lyons and busted him open, and apparently Lyons just shouted, "That's, we need more of this fucking shit, we need it." And then I think Bernard Flynn tried to apologise to him in the showers afterwards, and he was sort of like, "For what? It's only a bit of blood." And he was delighted, you know, that the young whippersnapper in the corner was now toughening it up as well.
Jesus, absolutely brilliant. I love Mick Lyons. Mick Lyons, we have to get Mick Lyons on the show. There's no doubt about that. I can't find an All-Ireland on YouTube that Meade won that I can get Mick Lyons on for. Although there's a list of Meade players that you would be looking for off that. But Mick Lyons probably definitely on top of the list. All right, we'll leave it there, Conan, because Cork captain that day, Larry Tompkins, joins us on the line now. Larry, we were talking about Colm O'Neill getting sent off. I suppose he had to go, really.
Well, I suppose it was fairly blatant, but fairness to me, he just walked away as it was. But, you know, it was kind of in the front of everybody, so he wasn't much of a jab. But look, I'm sure Callum had both crimes about being sent off, you know what I mean? It was just spur of the moment thing. But it was just, do you know what, it was just an awful pity because Callum was having one of those games that he looked like he was heading for. You know, Shea Fahey, he had a brilliant game that day, and I'd say it was either him or Shea. It was just one of those days. He was just winning everything that was coming into him. And I'm sure Mick was glad to see him sent off, because Mick was getting a bit of a run around, I think, at the time.
Well, that was the thing. That's why I couldn't believe it, that how Colm O'Neill was even getting frustrated. Usually you might do something like that if you're playing bad, but he was flying it. You would have thought it was Mick Lyons was going to be the one getting frustrated.
Yeah, I suppose you know what it was with Colm. Like, Colm was a very quiet fella, and, like, you know, for a long number of years he was finding it difficult to make the team and stuff like that. And, you know what, it was only that year, really, that he was on an ETF, but he's kind of been on and off for good years after that, and wasn't really kind of, I suppose, falling out of favour, and I suppose just got a little bit, lost his confidence and quality, but, you know, regained that confidence through the Munster final that year. He did a hell of a game, which a lot of people don't realise. He's kicked 11 points in Munster final, like, which is some performance. Like, Callum was one of these players, he was an absolute gifted player, like, you know what I mean? He'd put feet, like, and, you know, he was comfortable on board, like, and, you know, a good man for the big day. And I'd say, really, what it was, like, I'd say he was so psyched up for Mick, come hell or high water, like, it didn't matter whether it was physical or what way it was, like, Callum was there to win the battle, and that's the way he kind of, I'd say, it was just spontaneous, just that kind of a situation. It was just a spur in the moment thing, and just totally out of character for Callum, because if anything, you know, people would deem him to be a bit of a teddy bear down here, you know.
Right, okay. You made an interesting comment I was reading, is that nobody sat on the seats at half time after that, and nobody went over to console Callum.
No, look, it was, I suppose that's how focused the team was, and
whose idea was that?
Well, like, look, it was an awful build-up. Like, there was a lot of, I suppose, a lot of some hatred or whatever way you want to put it with Mead and Cork over a number of years. And Mead had kind of come out on the upper hand in 87, 88, controversially, after replay. And, you know, we played them in the league semi-final. It turned out nasty. It was Mead beat it again. And a lot of nastiness that day as regards, like, a lot of, you know, a lot of confrontation, a lot of battles, and a lot of physical battles, and a lot of, I suppose, come over the, again, a lot, you know, a lot of sting to it. And I think that after that league semi-final that year in 1990, I think Cork were in a good place, like, to play Mead the next time, because I think it really focused everybody. And I think what you're seeing at halftime when Callum got sent off was just that. It was just a spontaneous thing. Look, we have half the job done. Let's get out there. And, you know, they couldn't wait to get back out there again. And, you know, everybody was up. And it was a very unusual thing in this dressing room. Like, nobody was sitting down. Nobody was consoling Callum. You know, he had been sent off. I don't think some people didn't even realise that he had been sent off. That's how focused they were. It was a case of just trying to get out there as quick as possible and get the next 35 minutes done and beat them, you know?
Right. You mentioned that league semi-final, and I was reading Billy Morgan got down on his knees in the dressing room and prayed to a mighty God that those boys in the other dressing room would reach the All-Ireland final, because we'll be there.
Yeah, well, there was a lot of anger on that game, and a lot of, as I say, off the ball stuff all over the field, and it left a sour taste. And there was battles going in at half time through the old tunnel. That time it was the old dressing rooms, and you know, it was a lot of bad feeling there that day. And the guys, like, you know, I think if it was the day that Cork woke up to the fact, like, that, you know, we needed to beat Meade. That was the day that woke us up, you know.
Yeah, exactly. And like, I mean, because Meade kind of had accused Cork of being overly physical in 88, and then Meade were overly physical in the replayed game, and then were Meade the aggressors then after that because they thought maybe this was the way to beat Cork?
Yeah, I suppose 88 was a game like that. Look, you know, we should have won that game. It wasn't a case that, you know, I suppose with the help of Sue Rue in relation to his refereeing, and you know, we all blame referees at times, but like, you know, when time was up and he told me there was the last kick of the game, he still played on 3 minutes afterwards.
Jesus, know? Right.
Like, how amazing, you know, amazing. Like, he told me, like, this, you know, time was up, it was the last kick, and I put the ball over the bar, and we went to fight ahead, and Dave Barry jumped up on my shoulders and thinking the game was over, and he let the come out from McQuillan, and Shea Fahey cut the kick out cleanly and went to fist the ball to Tony Nation, and the ball ended up over the sideline, and he still let play go on. And from that time, he had to kick the ball from the ground, from the side of the kick, and ball went into the square and the melee, and he gives a 14-star free, like, you know.
Right, okay.
An incredible, you know, if you've seen the scenes afterwards, it was just a culmination of, you know, what was he saying to me when he told me it was the last kick of the game, you know?
Yeah, that doesn't make sense. After the replay, some of the Cork lads wouldn't go to the banquet.
Yeah, sure, look, there was a lot of bitter feeling there, and, you know, I suppose it, you know, Meade were a hell of a team, and Cork were a hell of a team, and two giants came together. A lot of controversy arose from the first day we played them in 87 right through, and I suppose both teams were desperate to win because, you know, Kerry had a long period of time and hadn't won All Ireland for so long. Meade probably similar, but for some reason they took it out on each other, and I don't know whether it was a culmination that did myself and Shea spur it on then as much, because we were from Kildare, and, you know, we knew the Meade lads well, like, and I was very friendly and still very friendly with all the Meade lads. So I don't know, that's the way it was, but look, I always say like this, you know, my All-Ireland final in 89 is great. We beat Mayo, but if we didn't beat Meade, like, that All-Ireland final wouldn't have meant as much, you know. So
Right, I get you.
And we you know, it's like carving down here and we can't beat Kerry, like, you know what I mean? You know what I mean? Kerry are the big team in Munster and you must beat them, like, and, you know, particularly beat them down in Killarney, like, so you have to beat them, and that shows a good bit of guts to do that. And I think, you know, if there's the big teams are in front of you there to be beat, and, you know, if they didn't beat Meade, you know, beat somebody else even to win two in a row, it wouldn't have been the same, you know what I mean? So
no,
I think beating Meade and beating them with 14 men, and particularly the way Colm O'Neill was, just me going back to Colm, you know, he was having such a hell of a game, like, and to lose him and then and still to go on and win, so that was even a better feeling, you know.
Yeah, in fairness, they left Mick Lyons as the spare man, and you were very clever in that you never kicked any ball down on top of him. You played the corners, Paul McGrath. And,
yeah. It's amazing. Like, Mick stayed right behind. Like, I was playing centre forward. Like, Jesus, like, Mick kind of stayed right behind me. And but Mick is, you know, Mick was a hell of a player, like, a fantastic player. But I suppose his main thing was, like, just, you know, he was able to blot out guys. That was his big thing. And I suppose when he seen himself, you know, he was kind of marking nobody. He might have found it hard to kind of adjust, you know. So, but look, we had a, I suppose there's no saying, like, our half-back line that day was superb, our midfield was superb, and that was really our launching pad really throughout the game, you know.
Yeah, were you carrying an injury into the game that was mentioned in commentary?
I had a calf muscle injury, yeah. But, and then ended up, like, doing my crochet then with about 15 minutes ago, so.
Right.
I said it's amazing because a few minutes before that, Lord of Mercy, McCarthy went down with a knee injury. He went down and Dr. Colin Murphy took him off. So, geez, when it happened to me, it was just a collision with Martin O'Connell. I just came out the wrong way, and that was it. But, you know, popped up off the ground pretty quick. But look, you know, momentum keeps you going, and when you're not in final, you just try to get to the defensive line. You know, maybe if I had him in the first 15 minutes of the game, and actually I wouldn't have lasted, you know.
Right, okay, so it was just a collision with Martin O'Connell, because I was reading the...
Yeah, it was just a collision, that was it. Martin is a hell of a player and a good, honest to God player. It was just Tugas, you know, went from hell bent for a ball just underneath the Hogan stand. You know, he was just getting there that little bit later, and Martin was just getting a bit first, and I just tangled. We just kind of tangled, and I kind of went one way, but we decided to go another way.
Right, because now Catalan has a theory on why you got so many injuries towards the end of your career. He said he put himself through ferocious punishment, and you'd wonder maybe if all that effort shortened his own career a bit. The training you did, with all the training, training you did kind of came back on you towards the end, maybe with the injuries.
Yeah, like, I don't know. Look, I done two crucial ligaments. I done that one in 1980. I was making a great recovery back in, was back really playing well again in 1983. And my second one went in a club game. People say that, but I don't believe it. I just think it's just, it's been damn bad luck. Just the incidents that happened, like, I think that doesn't matter of what type of thing, it was just the incident. The second time I just went up high for a ball awkwardly and came down kind of with my knee kind of in a twisted position and landed and severed the other knee. So, look, I just think you can be just unlucky the way it can just happen, and that's my own opinion. You know what I mean? It's just some people. I had a brilliant run up right up to 1980. I had really no injuries, and Then all of a sudden, I got struck down with a lot of them, you know. So,
but I suppose all the stories you hear about you with the training, like you're training before, you know, in the almost like what you'd hear teams doing now, training, doing weights in the morning. You used to cycle to Mitchelstown. Is that true? Like you used to do all sorts of training.
Yeah, like, so look, I enjoyed it. It was rehabilitation as well. Like, you know, I'd gone to England a good few times for rehab in Lillishalley, 3 weeks in Old Trafford, and treatment there as well on other occasions. So, like, look, I got a good bit of experience from being in these kind of professional places, and had a kind of a good team in relation to how to maybe prepare and predict it coming back from an injury, like, you know what I mean?
Right.
So everybody tries to get the best out of themselves, and that's all I was trying to do. It wasn't, you know, I used to get on with a lockdown to the Mardyke and kick a lot of footballs, and just general things that you wouldn't kind of, you go training collectively with a team, you know what I mean? Everybody has kind of certain weaknesses, and a lot of those weaknesses you don't really work at training. So, like,
yeah,
it's very important, like, to be able to go out there and try to kind of, I suppose, trying to improve on those areas. And as I said, you have an hour and a half training. You know what I mean? You don't get to do those things. So it's important, like, the guys kind of, you know, put in that bit extra, you know?
Yeah, no, I think that's true for any era. You used to give out to Billy Morgan telling him the training wasn't hard enough. You said, I'd do training like this before my breakfast.
Well, I just felt like this, you know, when I joined Cork, like, you know, Cork are a hell of a team, and like, one thing with Cork, even to nowadays, people will be questioning this and that, which Cork always have, will always have great players, but, like, I suppose the little bit of thing that you'd be a bit worried about them is that just that bit of hardness and that mental toughness that you really need when it comes down in a battle, like, and that comes from, like, from preparing, doesn't it, and to being together and really working hard, and you know, look, I know Billy in America, and look, it was just a comment I made, like, that I just felt like that training wasn't really, you know, it wasn't that hard, like, you know what I mean? So we just needed to step it up, because if we're going to beat Kerry, you're going to beat Mead. You know, there was no way to Nancy Danner, unless you had to get down, and guys needed to come in to train, and there's a big commitment now. You guys, particularly in any county, but particularly in Cork, like, they're coming from every angle and distances, and it's a big county, and you're committing there. The guys are coming up there from West Cork, it's an hour and a half, 2 hours drive, same going back down. Jeez, that was a good system, you know?
Yeah. No, that's what you want. Come here, maybe this will be not a fair question to ask you, but, like, I mean, without yourself and Shea Fahey transferring to Cork, like, well, my opinion is that Cork wouldn't have won All-Ireland. Like, it was some luck for Cork that the two Kildares, two of the best players that's ever played for Cork, came from another county.
Well, maybe they might have won more, I don't know. See, you never know. Look, you know, I hope I contributed something, and you know, people ask me, what did it, if there was any one thing that stood out to contribute to Cork. And I'd always say, like, that, look, I just thought I just upped the intensity of training. And in fairness to the likes of, you know, Niall Callan in particular, you know, Conor Coonan, you know, Teddy McCarthy, Shiffey, these guys ended up good leaders behind us, and really, you know, they really got behind the bus then and drove it on, you know what I mean? So, you know, it doesn't take one. It's, you know, you need a few behind you and you need a few good, hard leaders. And, you know, that's what we, you know, if there was anything that I contributed, it was just to try and, I suppose, just to try and get the level of training to be at a good intensity. And, you know, it's better to be going two nights a week of training than be going at four doing nothing, you know what I mean? So,
yeah. Yeah.
You know, like, people forget, like, it's all about quality, like, you know what I mean? And I even think, like, you know, to even the modern day, like, you know, teams tend to maybe go overboard collective training, and a lot of times they're coming in 4 and 5 nights a week, and you just wonder, like, you know, what are they doing, like, in a lot of those nights? Because, you know, you get fed up with one another, and you get a bit stale, and, you know, it's important, like, that the training sessions, you have an appetite, and that, you know, that you're going there, the quality session is good, and you come away there knowing, like, that it's worthwhile.
Yeah, exactly. What's the relationship like with the Kildare support now? Is there a bit of slagging, or would they be kind of...
You know, Jesus, I've got massive support from Kildare, and both myself and Shea, when we were playing here in Cork, like, that, Jesus, they were the first messages that were coming to us all the time, wishing us the best of luck. So I think that, you know, I think at the time when I left, you know, talking to my own back like this, you know, all those Kildare players and all the clubs and all the people knew, like, this, you know, things were at a bad ebb in Kildare, and there were, you know, things weren't ran right, and you know, I gave it 110% for Kildare. I never missed a training session with them, even though it's like that time you'd be going along, maybe there was only 12 or 15 people training, like, you know.
Yeah. Were you as good a player with Kildare, or did you take your game to a new level with Cork?
I don't know. Look, I came on the Kildare team when I was very young, and you know, you I suppose you develop, and there's no doubt in that, but I suppose I've always felt like I had the ability, and but I needed to work on things. I think a big turning factor for me was, I suppose, educating myself and with the help of a few people, in particular Dermot Early there from Roscommon, Lord Merson. You know, Dermot was over in the army there in the Corps, and he kind of guided me in relation to, you know, with two guys that opened up a gym in this, and I kind of joined that, and really kind of, I was only 17 at that time, and that was a big help to me in relation to kind of getting physically stronger. And then I suppose heading to New York, where you have to kind of stand on your own 2 feet away from home, you know. I was only 21, and then playing football out there then, you know, there wasn't too many the referees blowing the whistle, so you had to be able to mind yourself. And that time in the 80s, like, it was hell of a football games in New York that time. Like, it was, you know, 8,000 and 10,000 people turning up to Gaelic Park every Sunday.
Really?
Like, yeah, like, incredible. Like, well, what you had was, I suppose, similar to me, I wasn't the only person that was heading to New York. It was the place to go, and there was stacks of players going over there every week and every day, and sure, all the teams were good. They had good quality players, like, and the standard of football was high. And of course, whether you played football or if you didn't play hurling, sure, you went to Gaelic Park every Sunday because it was the meeting place for the Irish. It was the connection for a job. It was a connection to, you know, get sorted with an apartment or whatever. So, you know, every Sunday you arrived in, you wouldn't know who you'd meet, you know what I mean? It was like home from home, and there was incredible crowds there. Like, it was just one of those kind of, you know, there was a 3 or 4 year period that time, like, we won 4 New York championships in a row. Like, it was never done before, from 85, 86, 87, 88. So it was, it was a golden period. And Donegal, believe it or not, had a, you know, that time, you know, people would say, nah, you're bringing some players from Ireland or whatever, but it was never the case with Donegal, because we had a very good office over there, and they were living over there, and, you know, they're from all different counties, and there was a good selection from Cork, and good selection from even from Down, Wicklow, Kildare, there was a few. So,
and what was your plan going over there, Larry? Were you emigrating for good, and then you just got an offer to come back to Ireland to Cork, or you know, how did that work out?
No, it was. I'm bringing out a book now, Gollum, this year, and it should be out now in the summer. Please God, with and all my people back now with the circumstances that we're all encountering at the moment, but. Okay, it was a simple thing, and I suppose there was a number of first time with Donegal from Cork, from Castlehaven, actually, the club I play with now. There was four left from Castlehaven came with Donegal over, the two Collinses, Martin O'Mahony and Martin Connolly, and of course, you know, from one thing to another, you'd be playing matches and you'd be talking about home, and I suppose over a few years, and they decided they were going to head back home to try and seek a win at County with Castlehaven, and it started as a joke, really. Then, geez, you should come over and play with us. Sure, you won't be going back to Kildare now after the controversy that you left and all this. So that's how it started as a joke. And it, I suppose the joke was there for a few months, and then it started gathering momentum. And look, Troy's just said, look, I hadn't been home for that time for nearly 3 years. And I wanted to kind of see mother and father and stuff like that. So I said, so what, to Lewis, go over and play with Castlehaven for the summer and come back again. Look, the rest is history. That's what happened.
You know? Well, it was a great little story. We'll look forward to reading it in your book, Larry. So
yeah, sure. Look, listen. You know what I mean. There were great times, and look, there were just often playing football or playing teams, and as long as I was lucky, I ended up in vocation school for Wicklow, and I went to Blessing, and then Kildare, and then Donegal, New York, and Cork. So, look, I'm a kind of a mixed up kid. But, look, it was, met a hell of a lot of good people, great players, and, you know, great players that never even, you know, contested a Leinster final, Munster final, whatever it was. Like, I played with players in New York, were as good as players I ever played with, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, some players don't get opportunities that other players get, and by winning in All-Ireland doesn't mean that you're special, you know what I mean? There's a lot of special players out there that never get the opportunity.
Yeah, well, that's true. Well, listen, you've done very well considering you had to overcome Kerry in Munster, and then you had to contend with Meath and a couple others then in the All-Ireland series. So, like, I mean, four in a row. Like, I mean, it was super, super achievement coming on the back of Kerry dominance anyways.
Ah, yeah. So, look, you know, there were magic days and magic moments. And, you know, in order to achieve that, you have to have, a really good squad, and you know, Cork were lucky. We had an abundance of a lot of great players, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Listen, Larry, thanks very much for taking the time for us. I'll let you go there.
You're welcome. Thanks.
Come here, I want you to talk us through the goal you scored in the county final after 15 seconds. I want you to tell me when you had goal on your mind.
Yeah, you've probably had a few 15 seconds experiences yourself. Break me off, show me what you got, 'cause I don't want no 1 minute man.
So Cork 11 points, Meath 9 points, and it's fair to say, Conan, this wasn't a classic by any means. I think it was a situation where the rivalry dictated that it was always going to be cagey. Defences were on top. It was hard hitting, an awful lot of mistakes. It was a bit, you know, we've kind of been analysing when football changed. This was more into the 80s, 70s realm of just kicking it on up there and hoping that it'll win it.
Yeah, and it was especially frustrating from a Meath point of view.
More from Meath, yeah, more from Meath than Cork, yeah.
And I can't believe they were in it and then away in the first half, because they just, every single ball, like, there was just no thought put into it. So much of it went out over the end line. A lot of the time, there weren't even players there. Like, the full forward line had drifted out and they were just kicking it in over their heads anyway. And yeah, it was actually quite a painful watch at times, yeah. You know, especially because at one stage, I think Beggy stabbed this lovely ball to Bernard Flynn, and Flynn put it over. He dummied and put it over on his left, and it's like, yeah, I'll do that more. Like, you know, that works. And just didn't look half the time, and they didn't care. They just loved it up there.
That was actually, I remember that because I put it into my notes. That was Martin O'Connell, who usually launches it, put a lovely ball in front of Bernard Flynn. And just before that, a decent ball went into into Brian Stafford and he kind of half punted it over off the outside of his boot. Yeah. They were the only two good balls. Like, poor Colm O'Rourke. Catalan was getting the better of him, but sure, he was been given 70-30 balls against him all the time. Like, I was just looking at it because O'Rourke kind of started getting on top coming up to half time and he caught a couple of great balls, and I was just thinking, imagine Colm O'Rourke got the kind of diagonal balls that were in, you know, that were given in the game now. Like, I mean, it's crazy some of the stuff they were expecting him to win.
It was, and like, again, just no thought in how to use him properly there. It's funny you say that, because remember we did the 93 game and he was co-coms, and there's a couple of like bad shots that Derry and Cork both had that day, but he was like, that's a great ball, but they were coming diagonally and coming at a nicer angle, you know, than the, he was getting high balls onto the end line, like, you know, where he was trying to catch him without going over. It was poor, and the two points that you mentioned there from Stafford and Flynn, like, there was only 30 seconds between them both, and you know, they were well able to do it. And actually, one of the most annoying things then for me was that they started rejigging the full forward line as if that was the problem. Like, you know, when they moved Colm O'Rourke into the centre and Flynn to the other wing, and it was everything outside the full forward line was the problem.
See, I think in a way, now Cork played a little bit better. Cork, Tompkins and Dave Barry dropped into midfield, and their two corner forwards seemed to be getting a lot of ball on the 45, and they were isolating Colm O'Neill in on McLyons, and that seemed to be working. But they seemed to play a more structured style, or a better footballing style.
I think you're right. And like, sure, how many times did you see like Paul McGrath, you know, swinging dummies, and Mick McCarthy coming out deep and getting ball? Larry Tompkins went very deep to get ball. Like, they got the ball into hands of players who could hurt me, and that they worked that through the lines. Like, you know, they got Colm O'Neill ball bouncing in front where Mick Lyons couldn't just maul him. You know, they worked to their strengths, whereas I think that was Meade's downfall. They didn't.
Yeah, no, it definitely was. And you wonder why Meade, like, yeah, they'd O'Rourke in there, but Jesus, look at the when you see Flynn and Stafford, what they could do with good ball. Maybe there's an element of saying, I'm just getting rid of this because if I don't, I'll be absolutely clobbered. I'm not saying they're afraid. I'm just saying, get it down out of the way. Don't get caught in possession, you know. And it seems to me, I'd say O'Rourke probably messaged them is, lads, get it in some way rather than not get it in at all.
Yeah, I was actually thinking, I wrote it down, like, this is one of the last times where it's like, you know, that whole, boy, kick the ball into us and we'll, like, you know, it's up to us then to win it.
Yeah.
And, you know, rather than not giving us ball, and that was taken to the extreme. No, in fairness, I watched the Derry v Down 94 first round, and again, the ball's just been moved so quickly. That was like, the ball was a bit better there, but like, that idea that you're saying about players not being caught in and out the pitch and not dallying on it, like, there definitely was still that in 94 where the boys got the ball and they turned and kicked it straight away.
Yeah. Did you notice the new rule in this game? So if you're fouled yourself, you could go off your hands. And if you weren't the person that was fouled, you had to go off the ground.
Yeah. And like, actually, there's a couple of times, like, it's like, you know, Meave especially slowed it down, because if, like, they got fouled coming out of the fence and they could have just moved it quicker, but they've dropped it for somebody coming behind them, and then the person is setting it up then on the ground whilst, you know, Cork are retreating back. And
yeah,
there was a couple of times like where Shea Fahey just plucked the ball then from a free kick of Meaves, and it meant nothing then, Meaves trying to win that ball and come out from defence.
It's a weird one that must have been just for that year, because I like, remember Keith Barr and all these back then in 92, that rule wasn't there in 92, I don't remember. I thought all frees were taken off the ground then.
Yeah, I'm not sure actually. No, like, it seemed to slow down anyway when they did put it on the ground.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. So it was, I think, what was it? It was 6-5 at half time, and Cork obviously had the man down, and you're thinking, Jesus, like, I mean, this is going to be a handy enough one for Meade, because the big mistake they made. Oh, before we get into the big mistake Meade made in the second half, what about the halftime analysis and entertainment? So Declan Nerney from Longford played two songs. So this is like bloody the Super Bowl halftime entertainment, and there was shots of the crowd and they're all enjoying Declan Nerney. If anyone's listening to this that hasn't seen it, go on. And if the only thing you do, because the match wasn't great, just watch the halftime analysis and entertainment. It's a classic. It's just Ireland in 1990. The halftime coverage was about 60 or 70% Declan Nerney and about about 30 or 40% analysis. And you had Charlie Mulgrew and Martin Carney. Charlie Mulgrew looked like he'd just been pulled out of a ditch. He didn't even fix his collar, and he was reading off his notes. Michael Lester introduces Declan Nairne. He says, the first Longford man for a long time to play in Croke Park. brilliant stuff.
Yeah, and like Charlie Mulgrew wearing like a Christmas jumper as well, that like your mom would have knitted for you or something. And then like Martin Carney's looks a bit more highbrow. It looks like a lecturer's big jumper, but both of them wearing their big woolly jumpers, and a handy half time for Michael Lester, who's just only there for 30-40% of the time, and then he's passing over to Charlie Mulgrew, who's just blatantly reading off his notes. He's holding his notes up to his face and reading them out.
Yeah, I think it was, or Martin Carney said it wasn't a roundhouse punch. It was just a little jab. Like, I mean, I don't think he was making a case for him getting sent off. But geez, in fairness, Colm O'Neill was distraught. It was just a rush of blood to the head, and he went, and that was it. But then, amazingly, Mead had Mick Lyons as the spare man, and Mick Lyons could be seen off shot, standing in his full back position with Paul McGrath and Mike McCarthy and these forwards buzzing out around in front of him. So it was like it was 14 against 14.
Like, I always think it's a terrible idea making a defensive-minded player your spare man. Like, it's just his natural inclination is always going to be to protect the goals, even when there's nothing on. It's always a just-in-case mentality. And I remember, like, I got so much slagging. Like, one of my first games was Skerries, like, coming as a Nordy person. I was playing in defence, but we were trying to push up. We had a man down, and we were trying to push up. But I wouldn't leave the spare man back, because it was like, well, he's a free man back here in front of the goals, but they were trying to just put on a press. And I wouldn't leave the football, so I was fucking everything up by just staying back. And then afterwards, it was like, you know, the Nordy who wouldn't vacate the goals, like, and take a chance. And that there is that sort of mentality there. Like, Mick Lyons is... he's going to go back and just protect the goals just in case.
Yeah, and Cork used their heads in fairness. Like, I mean, they kicked nothing into him. Like, I mean, that would have been a big mistake that, you know, could have been made back in 1990. And they played the corners. They kept it well away from them. Like, I mean, I say Cork couldn't believe their luck with the way Mead played the spare man.
Yeah, absolutely. And they didn't give Cork, or they didn't give Cork any questions, Mead. Like, you know, like, Cork didn't have to bring anybody back. They didn't have to worry about anybody hurting him. I think one time Mick Lyons came surging through the centre once, and that was it. I think he just kicked the ball.
Maybe the last 10 minutes is like he's after pushing up himself, but that's when they were desperate at that stage. They'd gone three, like Colm O'Rourke was desperately dropping back into midfield around that stage. You know, like, I mean, geez, Mead didn't play well at all. Like, you'd have to say, they just did not play well, and they were still in the game. Like, amazingly, they were still in the game. Bernard Flynn had that terrible wide that he won a free himself, and he went off his left. It might have been a tight angle for Stafford, but that would have sent them in, you know, level at half time. Like, I mean, and they missed some bad chances in the second half as well. Like, the big one, the big miss that they made was Brian Stafford with that free at the end, because that was a well kickable free for Brian Stafford, a well kickable one. And the way that ruined it is Mead won the very next kick out, and Tommy Dowd went for a goal because they were still two down. That game had a draw written all over it if Stafford had got that free.
Yeah, and like, you know, no one referees back then as well, they definitely would have played for that draw. But like, that was the killing of the game. And actually, Stafford just missed a few in that second half where you're thinking, oh my god, like, you know, they sort of kicked themselves out of it. And it's amazing to think that they kicked themselves out of it, because they were so bad in the entire game. But I think Cork missed their own chances in the first half, and actually, like, definitely, they would have just kicked that point and it would have been a draw, because I don't know if you noticed, but there were 13 seconds of normal time left whenever Cork got their last free, and then they took it. They took it about 30 seconds later, because obviously they were wasting time, and then the ref blew it up, so he didn't even play any injury time.
No.
And, you know, if Meave had it, just instead of Dowd having to go for that goal, he had just kept it over, it would have been game over.
I think it was 13 wides to Meade. Cork had six. And in the end, like, Colm O'Rourke had two bad wides off his left. You know, Flynn had a bad one from play. Colm Kyle scored a great point, and then I don't know what he was trying to do. Was he trying to punt it to Bernard Flynn, or was he trying to kick a point? I don't know. It just looked very awkward. But in fairness to Colm Kyle, he made a big difference. He came on at halftime for Colin Brady. And Colin Brady and PJ Gillick weren't at the races in the half-forward line.
No, they weren't. And like, Kyle was definitely a good change. I don't know what he was doing with that one. I think they were just all in the habit of lumping the ball. You know, I don't even think anybody would have thought twice about that at the time. But Brady, like, probably could have, I never liked to see a man coming off in the first half, but just wasn't giving them anything. And, like, you know, the Cork middle third was dominating, so he just needed a change in there. And I think Dowie probably could have come on. Like, obviously, we knew what he brought then, like, later in the years and stuff, but, like, just they should have been making those changes earlier,
yeah.
I think.
Well, he was 20 then. Like, I was interested to see what age Tommy Dowd was in 1990 and why he was a sub. Like, Tommy Dowd at 20, surely, like, I mean, that he should have been brought on sooner. Like, you know, for PJ Gillick, maybe, or whoever, wasn't really important. I think he came on for David Beggy, who was having a very quiet game by his standards, but you'd imagine Tommy Dowd would have added a bit of industry to the half forward line. You know, you don't want to be too critical looking back, you know, 20 years ago, but there was definitely, geez, Meade just, it's amazing how you'd say Meade just did not perform at all. Cork played better. Meade had 13 wides to Cork 6, and Cork won the game.
But it is like, we looked at the Stunning, or not, the Down v Meath game the next year in 91, and you know, like that's 2 years in a row now, like after Meath had already won it twice, and I'm looking at them sort of fairly unimpressed by it all. Like, you know, they have great players, but that's 2 games that they just didn't perform in, and yet somehow they were in both games with a chance to equalise at the
end.
Even but like, the Tommy Dowd thing, like, he was only 20, but like he was still like a bulldozer of a man. And it said in the little, I liked the little graphics that was coming up with their height and their weight, but it said he was only 12 stone. And I was like, oh, come on, like he's at least 13 and a half there. You know, he looked massive.
Yeah, no, well, he's always well built. But you're right, that's a weird one with Meade in that, like, you know, they just stayed in games back then. But like, it's not easy watch one or two games, you know, and make judgments on these players, even though Gerry McEntee was back to his fetching best, even though he wasn't as good as the next year, but he still caught a couple of spectacular ones. Man, that man could get up and catch a ball.
There's nothing, honestly, like, he's become one of my favourite players of all time. There's nothing more beautiful than seeing Gerry McEntee just jumping from about 10 yards behind and gliding across there. He just throws his body into things. He throws his body off people. He's always in the right place. He cuts out a lot of ball. Like, I've got a season ticket to the Gerry McEntee Festival. Like, he's a super player.
But it's gas. Like, I mean, Gaelic football back then was like hurling. You know, you just got the ball, you cleared your lines, and some lads fought and scrapped for it. And the odd time then you get a ball that would be picked out nice, but most of it was clearances. And even the free, like, it's gas with the frees off the ground. Like, I mean, like, you had Shea Fahey and you had Liam Hayes, Gerry McEntee fetching balls that we'd be used to seeing being caught in midfield, or fetching these on the 21 metre line, because, you know, everyone's in there waiting for this free to be lodged in. Like, it's gas really, isn't it? Like, I mean, it was a different world, but it was more, there's no doubt it was more gladiator stuff, and it was way more physical than it is now.
Yeah, but it was like hurling without the right equipment, do you know what I mean? So like, they were playing this game without a ball that could go that far, and yeah, so it seemed a bit pointless. At the same sounds as well, you know, when a player intercepted it and then blasted it away, the crowd cheered because it was like, it's away from danger, and now we've got a chance. And I actually think the way that game was, it was why McEntee was so good, because he read it so well, and it was easy to read because he knew it was being launched, so he always just dropped off 10 metres away from his man, and I think most of his catches were always around his own 45.
Yeah, in around there. Like, I mean, even hurling has moved. Like, hurling coaches would look at Gaelic football then going, what are you doing, lads? Like, hurling now doesn't even launch it like that. Hurling tries, isn't it mad? Like, how it's just evolved, and it's more based on appreciate the fact that you have the ball, and how that, you know, even throughout the 90s it was getting more of a balance, and we keep analysing. I think the 0-0 to 10 was where we saw the best balance of holding onto the ball, giving good ball in, and better play.
I think you're right. I watched it was obviously a Derry game. It was Derry v Dublin in the quarterfinal in 2007. And I was just thinking, football peaked at this stage. Like, you know, it was thrilling. There was no stupid ball that was quick. You know, and it was man on man as well, but it was good balls. It was really tough for the cornerbacks and stuff. And yeah, it was just exhilarating stuff. But like, I think when you look at just something like the block, it really does sort of sum up how much the game's evolved, because that's changed because of both teams in a way, like, you know, where defenders are always dropping off in the position and not giving you a chance to kick it, and they're not there to block, but also the guy with the ball is not giving you a chance to block because he doesn't want to be caught in possession and he's hand passing it off. And you know, so like, that's one thing to show you how far away the game is now. And what was really interesting is the crowd were so wowed, I thought, back then by a few hand passes stuck together because it looked very slick. You know, whereas now we're all like, ah, we're all fed up with it. Whereas back then I was like, ooh, like, you know, when you sort of work your way through a crowd and you kicked it in then.
Yeah, and they all like those illegal hand passes. Who was it, Mayo, we were commenting on for that All-Ireland that liked that underhanded one? When they did hand pass, it was a hand pass that would be illegal now.
Yeah, and it seemed to be a lot of balls just sort of picked off the ground. I don't know if that was just me, but it just looked like a lot of balls just been stroked off the ground and nobody like that. I think actually, funnily enough, the Colin O'Neill one was the only one for off the ground that I can remember in these classic games.
Yeah, maybe it was. Maybe it was. Right, Conan, we'll leave it there and we'll come back with performance of the weekend.
I've had fellas follow me, and not just Cork lads, you know what I mean? It happens, yeah. and it does happen, but I'll tell you one thing, it's a lonely spot, and the best thing you can do is keep moving, and I thought Connolly looked to be trying to do that the last time.
The camera show doesn't look great, there was, maybe if they could say it was theatrical or whatever, but like the reality is that there was contact, and I wasn't trying to win a penalty, I was trying to go out and win the ball.
You know, actually, it's funny, your man Conan, what's his name on your programme, like, I was wondering, was he at the same match as me? He was kind of making out terrible, but unlucky to lose, like. Let's go. 10% luck, 20% skill, 15% concentrated power of will, 5% pleasure, 50% pain, and 100%
reason to remember the name. All right, so performance of the weekend, and the first nomination has to be Shea Fahey. 4 points from play. All superb points. Like, I mean, the fetching, the fielding. He had a brilliant block on PJ Gillick. Like, I mean, it was just an all-round outstanding performance. And this is a Shea Fahey 3 years younger than the outstanding performance we saw him put in 1993, Colin. So, like, in our heads, Anthony Toole is the big dog in town. And then you realise Anthony Toole probably was probably thinking, geez, this Shea Fahey now has been on the go for the last, you know, 8 years. He's seasoned. And Anthony Toole would be like, geez, I'm under pressure here.
Yeah, and like, sure, he scored 2 points against Derry in the 93 final as well, like two lovely points. And that the first one he scored in this game against Meath was, it really summed up, because it was a class score. It was like from beyond the 45, top of his laces. He caught the ball, carried it in, and just booted
on the run.
On the run. And it was just after Colm O'Neill had missed a free. And it looked like, you know, like Derek Canny was talking about that won't do his confidence any good. And the camera shot to Colm O'Neill, and he was shaking his head and he was rubbing his hair. And looked like it did affect him. Like, you know, for God's sake, it was an easy free, but then Fahey catches the next ball and puts it over, and that's forgotten about. Cork are in the lead and they're motoring.
Yeah, and the other one was from this point too, was from an angle. The 2 points in the second half were two brilliant points off the inside. One was a huge thunderous one, and the other was a nice little clever short free from Larry Tompkins, and he just turned and put it over the bar. Like, 4 points out of the highest, you know, out of the very top drawer, out of 11 from your midfielder. Like, I mean, I'm going to talk about other good performances here, but I think it's very, very obvious who the man of the match in this one was for. Like, he was just head and shoulders above everybody else.
Yeah, and you mentioned the, you know, the midfielders being back at the 21 and outside their own goals and stuff. And like, he was there. Like, he was the most important player for Cork in that regard, especially in the last 10 minutes when Cork had their whole full forward line off and they were just sort of back to the wall seeing the game out. It was Fahey that was there as the rock at the back, you know, and it was giving them that drive still through the middle and like, to attack it. Like, yes, he got all those little class scores and the big scores, but you know, again, to go back to that 93 final where he clipped one on the outside of his boot as well, he was just a player who did have it all in the total mould, I suppose.
Yeah, no, he definitely was. Like, I mean, and one of the greatest thing about Shea Fahey's brilliant performances from Cork, from a Leishman, is that he's actually from Kildare. So they actually, like, this hurts Kildare people that Larry Tompkins and Shea Fahey left, and they left within a year of each other. Obviously, Larry Tompkins' story is that he emigrated to America, and he got friendly with some players from Cork, and he ended up transferring when he came back. He spent a year out in New York and then came back and started living in Castlehaven in Cork. And Shea Fahey was in the army, I think, or a guard or something, and he was transferred down there. It was a more regular transfer. I think he works for Musgrove's now. He doesn't work there at all anymore. So, like, I mean, it's crazy. The two of Cork's greatest ever players weren't from Cork. And if we're being honest, there is not a hope Cork would have won those All-Irelands without Larry Tompkins and Shea Fahey.
No, I don't think so. And I think, you know, obviously the quality that they bring and the leadership that they bring, but even just that mentality, maybe they over-egged it, I don't know, but just that trying to get Meath into people's heads. Like, you know, in that book that I talked about, Double Double, they described Meath as a freight train coming down the tracks, and Cork have to be ready for them because they knew if we want to win in All-Ireland, we have to get over Meath. So getting that into their heads and maybe bringing that outsider's perspective into the Cork camp, helps a lot for Cork.
I think that Niall Catalan deserves a mention because he started brilliantly on O'Rourke. Now, again, these were backs balls, but Niall Catalan had the unenviable job of marking Meade's, you know, most effective forward. And I thought he battled hard. Like, he's a hardy hooer, and he was just getting stuck in the whole time with O'Rourke. And that was a great battle right throughout the game.
And you talk about O'Rourke's, you know, two wides. It hit them under serious pressure from Callahan as well. He didn't look at the post. He probably didn't think he had time. That's what good defenders make you feel like. You feel like you can't look, you can't dally, you have to act now. And O'Rourke tried to swing both of them over his shoulders rather than face up to Callahan. And we know what O'Rourke brought to me. Like, you know, we saw it the next year when he came on. Like, you know, just that drive that he has and the way he can get through a couple of bodies. But he didn't try that with Callahan. He didn't have the opportunity.
Yeah, I know. I completely agree. Mix Slocum. It's the weirdest name. I never heard of him. Like, he's wing back on the Cork team. All the other names you recognise, you know. But, like, I mean, Mix Slocum. I've never heard it before. But he had a brilliant second half. And in fairness to him, he wasn't another man that liked to launch it. He liked to play tastier ball and, like, ball kind of in the forwards' favour. And he did really well on David Beggy, who, funnily enough, had switched over onto his wing in the first half as well. So I think he deserves a mention too.
Yeah, and I think Beggy had a 7 minutes purple patch where he just had a couple of driving runs that were dangerous looking. But
yeah,
when I saw that, it almost like hit home what a good game Slocum was having, because Beggy was out of it before then. As you say, he was lucky to not come off as well, you know, as well as his opposite number, Brady. But yeah, Slocum, like, was an all-around example of those players who was playing through the lines, like, and using Tompkins and using McCarthy and using Fahey, and instead of just kicking ball away. I think, in contrast to me, there was one time where Cork lumped it and there was nobody. Jerry Canny mentioned it in commentary, there was nobody inside the 45, but whoever it was just got the ball and kicked it into the full forward line.
Yeah.
And it was just two Cork players waiting for me.
One of David Beggy's good runs, it was a brilliant run from I think Beggy set up Liam, was it Liam Hayes who got fouled just outside the penalty area, which was a huge thing, because there was only maybe half a foot in whether that was a penalty or not.
Yeah, but I think the ref got it right.
He got it right, yeah. He got it right.
Free, yeah.
I think Kevin Foley deserves a mention too, because, like, I mean, he did a great job at Larry Tompkins in the three finals with Meath in 87, 88, and the replay. He'd scored 6, 8, and 8, and he only got 4 frees this time. I don't think he had a shot on goals, Larry Tompkins. Now, I think he might have carried a slight injury into the game. They mentioned that in the commentary, but Kevin Foley wouldn't have been a regular. He was a regular wing back. I think Liam Harnan was injured, and he wasn't playing centre back. But Foley did a very good job, and especially the first couple of times Larry Tompkins headed into midfield and got on a few ball, Foley started following him in then and kind of pretty much took Tompkins out of the game, I thought, in the second half.
He did. I think Tompkins actually had one shot at the goals in open play, and Foley came flying across and blocked it. It was an amazing block, and it was a real win for man marking, like, you know, and knowing who the danger man is as well, you know, rather than everybody following the ball, he just followed Tompkins, and then, like, he thought that Tompkins had got away, and then Foley was right on him and blocked it down, and just a great job on him. Like, you know, he was there with shoulders as well at the right time. Just that was a commanding number 6 performance from him. And yeah, probably a shame for him. Like, he's probably the best of the Meath players and probably didn't deserve to be on the losing side.
Yeah, I think Martin O'Connell deserves a mention as well. You see, Martin, Dave Barry was taken off and he was man of the match the previous year in the All-Ireland final, and a hardy looking fella Dave Barry was. Martin O'Connell would do my head in, and the amount of ball he ended up kicking away. But look, that was the game at the time, so you can't you can't take it away from him. But the amount of time this man's on the ball and the amount of tackles he gets in, and he's able to dispossess fellas. And, like, I mean, he was a phenomenal defender. And I do think if he was playing in the more modern game, he would turn into, you know, he would be able to fix his distribution. It's just that's what he was encouraged. That was what he was encouraged to do. So he was following his brief out to the letter of the law. It's just we're looking at going, geez, Martin, you don't have to stick every one of them off the middle of your bootlaces.
It's the exact same as Tomás Richey in 2005, and we were watching that Kerry Tyrone game back. And, you know, Tomás Richey is one of my favourite players of all time, but just kept getting the ball and kicking it in high, and there was no Kieran Donaghy, but they just kept kicking it in because that's what he was told to do. And like Tomás Richey, like, you know, Martin O'Connell was so imposing in the game and he got on so much ball. And I think you're right, like, you know, if he was told something different to do, then he would do it. But you saw every single ball from me was just being hoofed in, and O'Rourke and even Bernard Flynn, none of them were given out. About
no, no. And that's the incredible thing. I think one, like, they never complained. They knew that was just the way it was. And I think one ball was launched into O'Rourke. It went so long, it went over his head. And Bernard Flynn came in behind him and caught it after it bouncing. And it was like, right, well, you know, I'll have to work off some sort of bloody ball here.
Yeah, O'Rourke actually caught one over the end line as well at one stage.
Yeah.
Like, it was chaos. Like, it was just kicking in and let those boys at it. So probably, like, you know, Sean Boynton was thinking Martin O'Connell would have been one of his better players. We have him down here for that, but he probably didn't think that Martin O'Connell was wasting ball. He was doing as he was asked.
Yeah, no, it was unbelievable stuff to watch. But look, the performance of the weekend has to go to Shea Fahey, like we mentioned, just completely all over the place. And to think that him and Larry Tompkins transferred to Cork, it's beyond belief. Within a year of each other, and won two All-Irelands, four Munsters, they ended up breaking up the Kerry dominance in Munster. And I don't care. Cork wouldn't have been doing that without them. So, like, I mean, they will forever be loved down there. It'd be interesting to know what it's like if they ever go for a pint up in Kildare, or how that's kind of viewed then. Because I suppose when Larry and Shea were still playing in the early 90s, Kildare lost a couple of Leinster finals to Dublin. Like, two players like them, like, I know Meade were probably dominating, you know, the late 80s. That Kildare, they might not have made much of a difference with Kildare, but maybe in the early 90s when Mick O'Dwyer took over Kildare, they could have made a difference for them. But anyways, listen, that's not for me or you to worry about.
I was going to ask, is there any other county that you could have seen yourself playing for?
Not really, no. No. Oh, look, I'm always on record saying I'd love to hear Hill 16 chanting my name, all right? So that would mean I'd have to play for Dublin. But, yeah, no, not really. I don't think you really think about that. Like, I mean, look, I'd never transfer club either, you know, if I'm being honest. Oh, shit, I did.
I think, should I pull them up here?
Yeah, but look, I wouldn't transfer county, let's say that. Maybe I just didn't get enough offers. Right, listen, before I keep talking complete nonsense, we'll leave it there. We'll be back on Monday and we'll do another nostalgia show. So we'll talk to you then. Good luck.
I'm not finished yet. It took me a long time to get here.
Both parents have spoken with each other, and they regret what happened. They've had a frank discussion with each other, and they're both of them are keen to now focus on getting back their county jerseys.
But these fellas will get such a shit shock next Saturday evening that we'll put them back in their houses for 10 years.